God, take our minds and think through them. Take these words and speak through them. And set our hearts on fire for love of thee. Amen. Please be seated. I grew up the banker's daughter in Texas City. Well, one of the banker's daughters. It was one of those labels we are sometimes given in life that is unearned. What that meant to others in my hometown, I really don't know. But what I do know is what it meant to me. I was the only kid in first grade with a savings account. My sisters and I were frequently given cash by grandparents, aunts and uncles, well-meaning adult friends for birthdays or holidays. We were allowed to keep maybe a dollar of what we were given, something that I learned later on in life as cash on hand or liquidity. But with the rest, we were required to go down to the bank, fill out a deposit slip, and continue to build the balance in our individual savings accounts. A little later, my dad bought a piece of land in each of our names, a down payment, if you will, toward our college fund. These were the days long before the tax code provided benefits to parents, setting aside funds for their children's future higher education expenses. Great idea, you might think, smart man. But banker dad made it a learning experience for us. As continued payments were made on our individual pieces of property, we were given a ledger, and we were expected to make note of each payment made, calculating the interest included and noting the reduction in the principal of the property's note after each payment. Dad would ask to see our ledgers from time to time, ensuring that we were learning lessons on finance and money management. You should have heard me trying to explain the concept of the time value of money to friends in junior high. Yes, my parents are responsible for making me a geek. Given this background, it's not hard to understand why this parable always sounded so outrageous to me on so many different levels. That third slave, what a goob. If he didn't want to risk losing the principal given him by his master, he could have at least put it in a savings account like my own and earned interest. And then that master, whoa, he sounds as harsh as the third slave said he was. And later on I wondered, is the purpose of this parable to promote the profit-seeking, risk-taking behavior of capitalists? No, I don't think God is a capitalist. At least that's not seen anywhere else in the Bible. And then, what is this message we're supposed to get when the master says, "For to all those who have, more will be given, but from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away"? Is this some ancient form of trickle-down economics? This sure doesn't sound like the Jesus who fed the thousands on a couple of loaves and fish, does it? Jesus often told parables to not only challenge the way people related to one another, but also to challenge how they related to God. So with that in mind, let's unpack this parable a bit more, shall we? It was not unusual in the Greek and Roman empires of antiquity to have absent landlords. Servants were frequently given financial resources of their master with which to do their master's business. Now, clever slaves were expected to actually earn money for their masters by making deals in the commodities market or speculating on land. That is likely what the first two slaves in this parable did to earn such high returns on their master's funds, for doubling one's investments in antiquity was difficult with such low interest rates, and these were exceptionally high gains on the master's investments. When given their respective talents, each according to their ability, these two servants got to work, honoring their master's faith in them and their abilities. When he returns and sees how they fared, the master tells both of these highly successful slaves the same thing, doesn't he? Well done, he tells them. You have been trustworthy with little. You will be given more responsibility. Enter the joy of your master. These two servants nailed the assignment. They took action and were being rewarded by a deepening partnership with their master. But that third servant, somehow he didn't understand the assignment, did he? He thought the one talent given to him was like a fixed deposit that he had to guard carefully. The writings of rabbis of that time praise people for burying money as the means for which to keep possessions safe. I guess this third slave was just following the old rules, not realizing that his master was proposing a new way of living, a new way of relationship. That third slave was fearful, afraid of his master, afraid of losing what had been entrusted to him. And so he failed to produce fruit or to do anything other than protect what had been given him. When the master lives up to that slave's harsh opinion of him, I don't know if this is just storytelling hyperbole, but the master takes away the talent returned to him, gives it to the star performer, and casts this cautious and fearful slave from his sight. What I think Jesus is trying to tell us through this parable is that caution and fear have no place in the actions and lives of his followers. Being a disciple is not a passive stance. It is an active vocation requiring us to take action, be prepared to take risks, overcome our fears. We are being told that fear is not a good motivator, for it limits our ability to use our gifts, to take action, to take part in God's work in the world around us. As one commentator noted, the crux of this parable is not that there are those who have little and what they do have will be taken away from them. No, the key message of this parable is about those who do little with the gifts they have been given. Many years ago, the small group of which I was a member did a spiritual gifts inventory. This inventory was a series of questions that helped us identify which might be gifts and talents God had given us. I overheard one member of my group and an executive at a Fortune 500 company comparing his results with another member, disappointed with how few strong spiritual gifts he had compared with the other fellow. Well, that fellow replied by saying, Jim, you are fortunate to have such few spiritual gifts. The problem with having all these spiritual gifts is that I have to use them. Yes, we do have to use the gifts and talents God has given us. We are expected to use them for the benefit of the church, for the building of God's kingdom here on earth, and for the glory of God. And yes, that's a tiny and final plug this stewardship season to get your pledge cards in and to talk to Father Ray about how you can serve God at and through St. Paul's. Through this parable, we are being challenged to enter into a new relationship with God. God is not a harsh taskmaster. No ledger is being kept about what we have been given or what we owe. But it seems to matter to God what we do with what we have been given. Come, enter into my joy, God is telling us. Come and partner with me in the work that is at hand and that is to come. God is inviting us to partner with him. And it is a joy to partner with God, a joy to use these gifts and talents for the glory of God, be they needed in our homes, our relationships, our schools, our jobs, here at St. Paul's or in the community. God has need of us and our talents. The question is, how will we respond?